From KUAZ Radio in Tucson, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, Christopher Conover visits Davis-Monthan Air Force Base to find out more about work being done to keep the nation's aging fleet of A-10s up to speed. We'll hear some tunes from guitarist Matt Mitchell as he joins me in the studio to talk about his own approach to making music and the sound of Django Reinhardt. Pam White brings us the story of a 2-year-old boy who completely lost his hearing due to illness, and he became the first child in Arizona to receive cochlear implants in both ears. Children have often been shown to have a great facility to learn languages, and Luis Carrion will take us to a local school that attempts to capitalize on this ability and further the concept of bilingual education. That's all coming up next here on Arizona Spotlight. Back in 1976, a new class of fighter jet commissioned by the U.S. military went into service, the A-10. Tucson's Davis-Monthan was home to one of the first squadrons to fly the A-10. And now, over 30 years later, the Air Force Base is playing host to a second chance for these aging but still capable aircraft. Christopher Conover brings us the story.
The A-10, with its rounded nose and two huge engines on the back, is a familiar sight in the skies over Tucson. The plane is considered a battlefield workhorse, but it's also an old airplane. The first ones arrived at Davis-Monthan in the mid-1970s, and the design was expected to be retired 2 years ago. But they proved effective in the first Gulf War and in Kosovo, so the Air Force decided to keep them around. But in order to keep the planes flying, the A-10's wings must be taken off, fixed, and replaced, a job that falls to Tony Bangard and the staff at the wing shop at AMARG, more commonly known as the Boneyard.
Each wing is brought in. It's evaluated if it's going to be a SLEP candidate or not. Once that determination is made, we'll start our process and our SLEP mods. Most of the inspection is done on the trailers and on the floor. After that, it's moved to the fixtures. Once it's in the fixture, the modification will actually start to take place. About halfway through the flow, we'll induct the outer wings. The wing set has three separate parts, center and the outers. We'll induct the outer wings and we'll do the modifications to the outer wings.
When the wings come into the shop, they could be suffering from simple stress from use, but also battlefield damage. One of the things that must be replaced is ballistic foam that fills each wing. That foam is there to absorb shrapnel and protect critical fuel and hydraulic lines. The foam is custom carved by Angie Droetz, who began carving the foam 5 years ago. And at the time, nobody told her how to do it.
It was mostly just trial and error. I just kind of experimented with different types of tools, different just techniques and stuff, and kind of came out with a way that worked best for me.
And that work makes Angie unique in the Air Force.
Yes, I'm the only one in the Air Force that does this. And it took us a little while to figure out how to do it and what the savings would be. And we discovered that the savings is definitely much more to our advantage than buying.
And cost is a factor. According to a recently released Air Force study, the maintenance cost for the aging A-10 fleet rose from $1.7 million per plane per year in 1996 to just over $4 million per plane last year. The wing shop at AMARG can deliver a refurbished wing for a little over $2 million, saving the Air Force plenty of money. And it gets the planes back in the air quickly, according to Earl Wade with the A-10 Service Life Extension Program.
And once we get the wing, we have another 60 days, 59 days, where we finish off all of our TCR modifications, and then we move out to the flight line where we do some more tests, and then eventually we'll get a test pilot who will take it up, fly it around, make sure it'll do everything it's supposed to.
Parts for the wing repairs are bought, made in the machine shop, and even taken off some of the A-10s stored at AMARG. In all, the facility refurbs nearly a dozen planes a year, and the time it takes is decreasing, according to Wade.
It's kind of like a used car, only better.
The regeneration extends an A-10's life by 8,000 flight hours. If the plane is not in heavy combat use, that translates to nearly 20 years of service. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
You can check in on the latest work being done to the A-10 online with the links you'll find at KUAZ.org. This is Arizona Spotlight. One of the busiest and most versatile musicians playing the Tucson scene is guitarist Matt Mitchell. He began his musical career at the age 7 when he picked out On Top of Old Smokey on his aunt's electric keyboard. After an early education that included classical piano, Matt switched to guitar at age 14 and never looked back. I sat down with Matt in the KUAZ studio to hear some tunes and talk about his fearless approach to playing new music. Thanks for coming down.
Thanks for having me. It's awesome.
Well, let's talk about how you got started in music. How long have you been playing guitar, and what brought you to the guitar in the first place?
I've been playing about maybe 21 years. I played classical piano when I was like from 8 to 12 and quit that just because of the discipline of it. I sort of rejected the, you have to go practice. And so, and then as I became, you know, a teenager, I got into rock and and wanted to play guitar for that reason. So as a teenager, you know, I played like Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and AC/DC, and it was kind of a retro 60s vibe among my friends in the 80s.
Yeah, right. That was going on a lot. And you needed to rebel from the classical training that you'd had.
I guess, yeah, it's all part of that whole thing. Yeah. And it was just the sounds I was really into too. You know, just those rock sounds is just what I liked then.
And now that's led you to a situation in Tucson where you are doing a bunch of different things in different venues, and you feel comfortable doing that, just switching hats? And
yeah, I mean, that's what makes it kind of more palatable to do, because if you just play one style, it can get kind of boring.
Yeah.
You know, so actually right now I'm not doing a lot of non-jazz stuff, but in the past I've done a lot of non-jazz stuff, and that makes a much more well-rounded
Well,
career.
I know that there was a klezmer metal band for a while.
That was a lot of fun. El Creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah. We did klezmer and Eastern European folk music and Middle Eastern folk music done like heavy metal style. That was a lot of fun.
Let's try to give, if you can, our listeners a definition of what klezmer music is.
I mean, I play it and I know what it is instinctively. You know, Jewish music that accompanied weddings and special events, you know. And, of course, Jews are all over the world, so, you know, Ethiopia, Russia, et cetera. But we mostly play Eastern European Jewish music and some Russian stuff and some jazz and stuff.
And another thing that you've been doing recently is playing music that's often described as either hot club music or Django Reinhardt style, acoustic jazz generally. This is usually involving, what, a couple of guitars, a stand-up bass, and a violin.
Yes. Yeah, or a clarinet sometimes. Uh-huh. Django's later groups had clarinet. And that's been a lot of fun. Partly it's been as a result of the just increase in awareness of that music across the country.
Well, maybe you'll give us an example of that.
Now,
when I hear Django-style acoustic jazz, the first thing that jumps out at me is the rhythm guitar kind of chugging along.
Yes.
And that gives it sort of this kind of drive where you don't need a drummer necessarily.
Exactly. The rhythm guitar player is kind of like a drummer. And some people criticize the music because it can be kind of the same rhythmically, but it's kind of a nice backdrop to do all the fancy stuff on top of.
Okay. Well, can you give us a little example of a Django-style rhythm guitar?
Yeah.
That was great. That was really great. And Django, as most people who are familiar with his music have probably heard, his hand was burned badly in a fire.
Right.
He was a violinist originally, who then gave up the violin and started playing guitar.
But banjo first, actually, like a six-string banjo guitar.
Okay.
Yeah.
But so he was really doing all of his cording with essentially three fingers, right?
Two fingers, and then the pinky and the ring were kind of fused in a mass that he would use only on chords. So single lines were just the two, the index and the middle.
Well, Matt, we're going to let you play some music for our listeners. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for coming down to the studio, and we'll just let you play now.
Thanks for having me. All right, this first tune is a Gershwin tune called They Say It's Wonderful. ¶¶
Keeping up with Matt Mitchell can be a full-time job, so follow the link you'll find at KUAZ.org to Matt's page, where he keeps a schedule of his upcoming shows. Coming up in the next half of Arizona Spotlight, we'll hear about the medical advances in restoring hearing to the deaf and what it will mean to the future of one very brave little boy. And we find out about the International School of Tucson, where students have to learn to think fast in two or more languages. That's next here on Arizona Spotlight. Since it was approved for use in 1984, a device called the cochlear implant has made hearing a possibility for the deaf and hearing impaired. Globally, only about 4,000 people use a cochlear implant in both ears, but over half of these recipients have been children. Next, Pam White brings us the story of one little boy who's making medical history in Arizona.
2.5-year-old Anthony Deeby never had a hearing problem until he got a severe case of meningitis last Christmas.
It looked like he had an ear infection. It turned out he had meningitis. By the time I got him to the hospital, it was serious.
Anthony's father, Thomas Deeby, said his son was so sick he almost didn't make it. But after 17 days in the hospital, he pulled through. Except for one serious complication, Anthony couldn't hear.
And it lasted for 2 or 3 weeks before we definitively knew he was deaf. And he was not only severely deaf, mildly deaf, he was profoundly deaf in both ears.
And so he went from an environment where he heard everything fine and was developing speech as a 2-year-old would, to an environment devoid of sound.
Dr. David Perry is a fellowship-trained pediatric ear, nose, and throat specialist at UMC and Anthony's doctor. he recommended trying high-tech ear implants called cochlear implants to help restore Anthony's hearing.
Well, this is a picture of the ear, and this is obviously the ear you see on the outside, and this we call the ear canal, and there's an eardrum that separates the outside world from the middle ear. And here's some little bones that, when the eardrum moves, they move, and they move a fluid inside this snail shell tube, which is called the cochlea. And that's where we actually hear sounds.
The procedure involves surgically implanting an electronic device that directly stimulates the cochlear nerve.
Magnet here, you can tell, attaches it, and it sends information from the outside world through this magnet, which then gets to the internal processor and then is transmitted along the implant into the cochlea and then ultimately to the brain.
Because the implants are very expensive, several thousand dollars, most people have just one. But studies show two are much more effective. In Anthony's case, Dr. Perry wanted to implant both ears, not only to give him a better chance of hearing again, but because Anthony's illness had left him little time for options.
And after you get meningitis, there's a time frame for many children after which there's no chance of putting in an implant because the cochlea has become what we call, say, ossified or full of bone. And you can't simply place this small little electrode inside that tube. So there's a bit of an urgency. Typically, it's a one-sided implant. But again, in kids who have had meningitis, we try to do both sides because if you want to do a second side later on, you may not have the chance because it may be full of bone.
So surgery for the bilateral implantation was performed in March, just a few months after Anthony became sick.
A four-hour surgery, 2 hours per side, ended up being close to 8 hours, 7.5 to 8 hours, because he had what we were afraid of, and that is fibrous growth or ossification, hardening, a boniness of that inner ear. And had it gone any further, we would not have been able to do what we did. He would have been deaf for life.
And Anthony made medical history by being the first child in Arizona to receive cochlear implants in both ears at the same time.
He'll set an example for other children, and perhaps even his illness, once people understand what went on with him, they may be able to avoid hearing loss in their own children if they move quick enough.
Dr. Perry says the implants work much better in people who could hear at one time, and those implanted at an early age improve the most.
There are many, many children with cochlear implants who, by the age of 6, function in the mainstream environment. They go to school with other children and function appropriately because the implant really does allow for the child to develop communication.
If I call to him, he'll turn in that direction. He'll turn in the correct direction. But he doesn't understand if it's me, you, the doorbell, music, he's not sure yet.
But implants alone are not enough to help Anthony regain everything he lost. So he works with an array of specialists to develop all the skills he can.
It really requires a lot of effort. Effort by family and caretakers and audiologists. There's a very large team that's involved in trying to help them develop speech and language normally. And it's not as easy as simply placing a bionic ear and all of a sudden they can hear normally and well and talk.
And it's going to take a lot of work, but he has the potential to do anything we can do.
And with so many people working together to help him, the little boy now has a chance for a full recovery.
It won't be a situation where we feel like we have some handicapped child on our hands that's a burden. It's quite the opposite. You know, he'll be leading the way. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that he can hear now. And he hears sounds now, and he'll refine that, you know, as time goes on.
For KUAT, I'm Pam White.
The use and the effectiveness of bilingual education is often debated in our community. Educators who advocate dual-language curriculums can face political opposition. There's one school here in Tucson that's embracing bilingual education and is finding families eager to have their children take advantage of the benefits of being multilingual. Luis Carrion spent some time at the Tucson International Language School and brings us this story.
Currently, the trend is to build fences, the physical barriers of protection. And then we have measures such as the English-only amendment passed in November that are intended to offer a cultural protection from other languages. In spite of this climate of isolation, a new school that advocates the teaching of Spanish and other languages to our young children is gaining support.
We're offering an international program. It's a program that's all around the world. And it's quite common in the U.S. The numbers of schools offering this program in the U.S. are exploding.
Robert Young is the director of the International School of Tucson and is a strong advocate of multilingual curriculums for young children.
One of the key things about the program is that from grade one, students have to study two languages. And so we are starting with the three-year-old group, teaching them the non-English language so that when they get into grade one, they're able to follow a course of study in English and another language. It's what's known as dual language immersion. So the model we follow is 50% in English and 50% in, currently we have French and Spanish. We're opening a German program in January, and we're getting ready to open Arabic and Mandarin Chinese.
Bilingual education has had a controversial history in our region, and many of the policies being forced upon educators now seek to eliminate it altogether. However, many of these efforts work against the studies that suggest the benefits of multilingual education.
There is a part of the brain that's been identified for language use, and the more it's stimulated, of course, the more it develops. The younger the child is exposed to language, the more likely it is that he or she will learn language. There appears to be two main stages, roughly age three, to do with the sounds of the languages, and you've probably heard of the arguments for exposing the child in the womb to music, for example. Well, they're very receptive to sounds up to around age three. The other stage appears to be around age seven, which is where they're receptive to learning language and languages. And roughly around age seven, if that part of the brain hasn't been used, the brain will reallocate it to other functions, which is why as people get older, it becomes increasingly difficult for most people to learn other languages. De la maison?
Ça. Bravo. My name is Jennifer Richardson, and I'm a parent of my daughter, who is 4 years old. She's in the Spanish class, and I'm the president of the Parents Association. Well, really what we saw this school as was an opportunity for her to learn a language at an early age, which I think all research indicates is the best time to learn a second language, to have it just integrated into early development, into early education.
For Jennifer, as well as many of the other parents at the International School of Tucson, the value of learning another language at such a young age is very apparent.
There's a fairly wide variety of parents. There's a pretty strong contingency of parents who speak a second language at home and want their children to learn that language. Then there are parents like me that don't have a second language at home and just for the same reason saw it as an opportunity to integrate a language into early education. And then there are several parents who speak a second language at home and have chosen to enroll their children in a different language. I know there's a few children in the French class who speak Spanish at home, and there's one child in the four-year-old Spanish class who actually speaks Russian at home. And their parents just saw it as a way to get another language integrated into their education.
So, how is it that at a time when our social policies seek to restrict other languages in our community and in our public schools, the International School of Tucson is able to succeed by offering a curriculum that embraces a language other than English?
Well, we are an independent school, so a lot of the dialogue that has been occurring doesn't affect independent schools because people choose their school based on what the school offers. If they don't like it, then they don't go there or they go elsewhere. Public schools are not in a position to make those decisions. Those decisions are made for them. So a lot of the debate and discussions over, for example, making English the official language, are occurring at a political level, not an educational level.
At the political level, our society feels compelled to build walls that isolate us from others. But for the students at the International School of Tucson, the walls are being dismantled and replaced with the cultural bridges of language.
I also just think socially in this world it's important to know other languages and learn about other cultures. And I think that that's another thing the school has done a really good job of, is not only teaching the different languages of various countries, but also integrating into that the cultures that go hand in hand with those languages.
Language is culture. And just by being able to speak a language and read a language, the students have access to the other cultures. But language also reflects ways of thought. By being able to speak it and read it, the students will have access to that and different ways of seeing the world and different ways of describing the human condition that monolingual speakers, if they want to look at it will be looking at it in translation, in other words, through a filter from somebody else.
For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Luis Carrion.
Now we've got just enough time to hear a tale spun by the cowboy poet, Baxter Black.
Lo, the weary hunter came, no blood upon his hands. His darling wife in sweet relief bid welcome to her man. For 10 long days he'd hunted from ridge to rocky stream with sportsman cronies like himself. Alas, no elk was seen. He told her how at daybreak they'd light out from the camp and walk until their back and legs were knotted in a cramp. And then how around the campfire with reverence they would speak about their wives and families and their plans for Holy Week, of politics and health food, of hunting as a sport. And then, just for therapeutic sake, they'd have a little snort. She bore his epic saga, as wives are forced to bear, but winced when he said she forgot to pack his underwear. She stilled the mighty hunter. Her answer left him stunned. You must have overlooked him, dear. I packed him with your gun.
That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. As always, thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. Most of the music heard on today's program, including our theme, was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of past shows and podcasting of Arizona Spotlight are available online at KUAZ.org. I'm Mark McLemore.